From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in juicy Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development.
I'm Lydia Simchich, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Arthur Croy, I too make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are story players won't see and polished priorities. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start. Junction Jam.
Yes.
We teased this last episode, maybe. Oh, cut this if it's irrelevant, actually. Sorry.
No, don't cut it. It's hard to keep track.
Okay, yeah.
But we have talked about it on the show before.
Yes.
When we were planning Junction Jam.
Mm-hmm.
We might have been still calling it Trains Jam.
Oh, yeah.
At time.
Still a fun name.
I still like that name.
Yeah.
But Junction Jam is a little bit...
It's got the JJ and
stuff. It's really good.
I also like because it does imply that there's a coming together of... paths, yeah. Which is very much part of it.
Awesome. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's good.
So for listeners who need a refresher, the concept is that you may remember Train Jam from long ago, from Chicago to San Francisco, 4-day, I think, train jam or jam game jam on a train, which then ended as the Game Developers Conference started. And it was a cool tradition, went on for a number of years.
Yeah.
There has been a lot of efforts to revive the concept from many different organizations, including Global Game Jam. Whose executive director is local to our community.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a relationship with her. And when Sam and I, Sam Baseman, she, friend of the show, started up a little community group for different local game dev communities in the Midwest.
Yeah.
It's expanded since then. One of the things we all were sort of talking about is, wouldn't it be cool to put together a train jam? And somebody said, like, oh, I think Maria at Global Game Jam is actually testing ideas and wanting to do that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And Global Game Jam, they have, you know, lines on sponsors. You have more infrastructure than a lot of us smaller community organizations. So we invited her to the group and we chatted it out. And I don't know why I'm telling the whole story, but we brainstormed what something like that would look like.
Yeah.
And my idea was... I don't love the fact that it's a one-way trip.
Yeah.
Because it makes it expensive. You got to fly home. It's like a whole thing.
Yeah.
It's also difficult to commit for that many days.
Right.
And so we thought, well, how could it work for like this region, for the Midwest? And so we decided it would be great if we all took an eight-hour trip to Chicago, different Midwest cities, and then stayed overnight in Chicago, took an eight-hour trip back home. That's a two-day jam. That's about the size of Global Game Jam.
Mm-hmm.
And so from there, we had Ross from IGGA Chicago has done incredible amount of work arranging to get a venue in Chicago to put this on. And Sam and I worked together on sort of the structure of it and coordinating other folks to help on the different spokes of the trip.
Nice.
And Maria has done a ton of work like with the infrastructure and reaching out to sponsors, and all that work is still ongoing, but we're doing it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a pilot program this year. Participants need to buy a very cheap ticket to the event, mm-hmm. which is just the event in Chicago. And then they have to make their own way on the train and hotel in Chicago. It's a sort of a separate thing. We want to eventually rent out a whole train car, but now we just have the routes planned. So you know which route to get, and everybody else is going to be on that same route.
Yeah.
So it's basically... very similar.
Yeah.
And then there'll be organizers from the local communities on each of the spokes to help facilitate. A theme will be revealed as the train starts rolling, and you'll have all day to work on it. Then when we get to Chicago, you'll check into your hotel, and then we'll have volunteers to guide you to the venue where you will meet all the other communities from the people who arrived, and as well as people in Chicago who have been jamming there the whole time.
Yeah. Okay.
They're not on a spoke, they're in the hub.
Right, right, right.
And so it's a coming together. Anyway, that's the format. It's very exciting.
Yeah.
We're really trying to make this first year to prove out the concept so that we can make it bigger and better in future years and make it an annual thing.
Yeah, cool.
It's very stressful to put together.
Oh, for sure.
But the website is up now.
Woo!
So really, you know, book a ticket.
Yeah.
Ride the rails with us.
Link is in the show notes.
The jam takes place August 15th to 16th. It's a Saturday and Sunday event. So you don't have to take any days off work. You leave at, depending on which city you join from, and you can come from anywhere you like, but it's certainly more convenient if you already live in these cities.
Yeah.
Minneapolis, St. Paul, Kansas City, St. Louis. Those are the three spokes. and then they all meet up in Chicago, and then they all head back. So you get on your train, you know, 8 in the morning. You get into Chicago in the afternoon. You have the, you know, you've got the evening, the event that we all share. You get on the train the next afternoon, and then you get home in the evening.
Yeah.
It should be relatively convenient for people, we'd like to think. And we have contacts, and we have a Discord for people to start coordinating. We want to have teams forming on different trains.
Ooh.
You know, it's a whole thing. We're really excited about like the structure of it, but it's a pilot program, and so we actually just need people to sign up and do it. And so this is my pitch to you, dear listener. If you're in one of those cities, you can get to one of those cities, or if you can make it to Chicago, you can join them when they start jamming on Saturday morning and just stay there the whole time. All the information is at junctionjam.org. You'll see an option there for the Midwest version. There is also another version. This concept, we want to syndicate this concept.
Yeah.
And there's already a group in the UK who is interested in doing it, and they're planning an event in Wales.
Oh.
As a one way trip.
Dang.
To Cardiff. And there's information on that as well. If you are a UK listener, you can check that out. I don't know if all the details on that one are available, but it happens around the same time, also in August.
Mm-hmm.
Page for the Midwest version of this. That we designed has top to bottom all the information you need in the order that you need it to book what you need to book to make it happen. And
yeah.
We would love to see you there. That's the whole pitch.
I mean, honestly, I'm just excited about riding a train again.
Yeah.
A long time. And trains are great.
Yeah.
Yep. So, this will be great. Just working on stuff while you're on a train. It's exciting stuff.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it.
Okay. What else do we have to talk about?
Well,
you have apartment stuff, apparently.
I have apartment stuff. I think I took a break from talking about my new apartment on the program for a while because Dale and I bought a new place in January.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in the same building we currently live in. So it's just a place like ours, but bigger. And I don't know how much I shared back then, but the plan is we bought the new place. We are renovating it.
Mm-hmm.
We're knocking down all the walls. It's a big renovation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's where all of our money is going because actually buying the place was very cheap. The renovation is not cheap.
Yeah.
But it's because one of the reasons why we got it at such a good rate is because the layout of the space was just complete nonsense. And so, we had the imagination for like, how can we actually make this a really good use of this space?
Yeah.
And so we're in the process of doing that, and it's taking a lot longer than I'd hoped. And we are simultaneously trying to sell our current place.
Yeah.
And the longer it goes, the more interest on a loan and being responsible for, you know, utilities across two things. It's been a very stressful spring for me.
Yeah.
But, some recent updates is like, they've done most of the demolition on the new place.
Cool.
They're going to start to put up walls.
Okay.
That I've laid out. I've designed this place. It's really cool.
Yeah.
It's not something I really ever thought I'd be able to do, is to like design my home.
Yeah.
It just wasn't as, you know, I mean, it helps that I didn't move out and build a giant like suburban house. You know, it's a condo in the city. It's not it's not huge.
Right. Right.
But it's a very empowering as someone who is. As a game designer, like I do user experience, I do graphic design, I do, you know, layout and all that. And it,
you're level designing your home,
designing your own. Yeah. Level designing your home, thinking about like the steps it takes to get from, you know, my home office to the fridge, like, like all that stuff.
Yeah.
Like making sure things are lined up quite right and being very like picky about it. And I get to be the sort of customer with the contractor.
Yeah.
I need it exactly the way I want it because I'm paying so much money that I feel finally kind of entitled to just like say it needs to be exactly 2 inches to here. And like, okay, like it's
wow,
great.
Nice.
But there has been some troubles lately.
Yeah.
We're going to this new phase of actually like we knocked down a bunch of stuff and now we're building stuff. But the contractor was trying to save me some time by overlapping things a little bit.
Oh.
And so, but they didn't have the final approved plans.
Yeah, okay.
Mm.
Which we can't really get because you can't, because of the way our building is 50 years old. And so, like, even when you take measurements, it's not actually the exact dimensions of every corner. It's a relatively squared off place, but you have to actually just, we've been putting painter's tape down on the floor. Like, this is the floor plan.
Mm.
It's now that all the walls are gone, we want to have like a 1-to-1 map. Rather than just have things on paper, because all the draft floor plans we've been doing are all with the caveat of like these might be off by a couple inches.
Yeah,
you know, we don't know. It's really hard to tell. But the contractor kind of looked at the drafts and said, "Well, these things we're pretty sure we know. These things we'll wait till later." And they kind of made a judgment call, and then they built like three walls in the wrong place.
Oh shoot!
So yeah, they're eating the cost of that. It's not a big deal, but it's meant that I wasn't expecting this process to happen. I was expecting a lot more of a, let's take a week to like lay it all out, walk around and kind of get a real sense of the, any final changes. Cause it's like, I do kind of plan to live here the rest of my life. But that's all being compressed now because they're sort of, you know, they bought a bunch of material. They're ready to start doing. And like, as much as it was their fault, I would like them to make money on this project. I don't want them to, you know, I want them to have a good time.
Yeah.
I want to have a good relationship with them. So I'm doing my best to try to accommodate them jumping the gun a little bit. Because it also does mean that maybe I can move in a little sooner.
It does sound, it sounds like they were trying to help you out, but that it was
exactly what it was.
So, you know.
You know, I'm a layperson when it comes to a lot of this stuff. Mm. So I'm like, well, I would like this wall to terminate here, but I actually don't know what the code is on how far from standpipe drywall needs to be.
Yeah.
You know, it's actually kind of relevant. And so I've been sort of waiting on some information. We're doing some HVAC stuff.
Yeah.
The contractor knows about all these systems and knows what they can do before waiting for other things. Whereas I'm like, I would like all the answers before deciding anything.
Yeah.
Because, and I think this is where I come down to like, I'm the sort of like, you know, I'm the designer here. Mm. And so I think the contractor is like, let's get a functional thing that fits the spec.
Yeah.
And like, that's a really good attitude.
Yeah.
If we need to actually lower the ceiling by 3 inches, that's going to impact where I want to put that wall.
Right.
And I think that's something that like, so that is the stress I'm dealing with right now.
Yeah.
Along with planning Junction Jam.
Yeah.
Working on my new project.
Yeah.
Doing updates for Blippo. And
yeah.
And yeah, it's a whole lot, but I thought I would just check in on it. And you're probably not going to hear me talk about this again until I move in, I hope, unless something crazy happens.
Sometime soon.
Yeah, it's not interesting content, I'm sorry to say, but I just need to talk about it for a second.
Look, we have this program for a reason, and that reason is for us to rant about things.
Yes.
Speaking of ranting, Lydia.
I don't actually have a rant this time. So last Friday, my friend Daniel, he ran a one-shot in D&D 5e wherein the idea is that like every 100 years, these monsters come and attack the world and adventurers save the world, and then all happens again in 100 years. And at this point, it has happened enough that adventurers are kind of passe. And so it's now made into a like reality TV show where all of the contestants are all adventurers and influencers. Mm-hmm. So we had to come up with a character for this one shot who was an influencer from any platform, but it had to be like an archetype. So for example, we had one person who was a 2016 era beauty vlogger.
Okay.
Anyone who was following that from knows the vibe.
Okay.
And she played it to a T. As a person who consumes a lot of YouTube over the many years, I had a lot of like, okay, well, how do I want to do this? There's a lot of options and wells of creativity I could pull from. I was trying to decide what character I was going to be. I remembered, I made at one point a kind of riff on the lasers and feelings system, as many people do. Maybe as a riff on the Muppet Babies system. There's a lot of versions of this.
Okay.
But I came up with one called Content and Influence. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I know that's in my drive. Let me see what I wrote there and see if I can have some ideas. And it's actually surprisingly complete. Like, actually, I have the player-facing sheet, and it has instructions for the player. It has suggestions of different YouTubers that you could play.
Yeah.
You can even roll for a D6 for what your sponsor is. Your roll for the panel title, there's 1 through 10. And I also came up with different ways to win the game. So the premise of the game is that the group, you are all YouTubers who are going to be on a panel in VidCon that's like right at lunchtime. You have been so busy, you need to get food. You don't have a lot of time before your panel. You can't be late to that, but you have to find something to eat beforehand.
Okay.
And because it is lunchtime, everybody is flocking to the food trucks and stuff.
Right.
So you're not going to be able to do that. I was actually very genuinely surprised at like, this is like, I could maybe run this. I just would actually have to learn the lasers and feelings system.
Yeah.
Okay. There was a period of time, I think we even did a session zero where some friends and I were going to do it online and we never actually started. And now I'm just kind of sitting here looking at this thing I made going, I did kind of an okay job.
Don't you love it when you go back to stuff and you're like, you know what? Actually passed me. Kudos.
Yeah. And I'm trying to figure out, is there anything else I need to do with this? Do I just like run this as a playtest? And I also, it's very much like, I did the thing where you do, where it's like, we can't put A1 steak sauce in the fridge, so it's B2 steak sauce. It is just rife with that.
Uh-huh.
Just all over the sponsors and the ways to win are, it's just full of it. It's very cheeky, very much like if you watch too much YouTube over the course of the years, you know. I'm also quite pleased with some of the panel title names. They're very, I'm very pleased with how funny it is, yeah. Or at least how funny I find it.
That's great.
So I gotta decide what to do with this.
It sounds like you should bring this to a playtest event.
Yeah, yeah. That's what it sounds like. I mean, I was also going to suggest it could go in the show notes.
It also could go in the show notes.
Yeah,
maybe it could possibility. Be
put it out on the Discord.
Yeah, you well, know, maybe. Get some input on that. Maybe. You know, a lot of options.
Well, if you're hearing this and it's not in the show notes because I've waffled for too long, yell at me in the Discord respectfully.
All right, Mark.
Yeah.
You've got a topic.
Yes.
What is it, though?
Okay, so the project I'm working on, the thing that I'm desperate to spend all my time on,
yeah.
Even though it's being sapped away by so many other things,
yeah.
A project where you're in a space. It's a lot of environmental storytelling. It's a puzzle-adventure game,
mm-hmm.
Where you navigate a space, unlock, you know, like you'd expect from a Myst,
yeah.
style game.
Yeah.
There's a lot more to it, but that's not the area of this topic.
Okay.
So, you know, we're going to fill this space with a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, puzzle adventure games do center the player a lot,
mm-hmm.
but they also tend to be the player uncovering the story of the world. What happened here?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Who are the principal characters? Why is it the way that it is? And that is a big draw for that type of narrative. My approach on this is to go in the other direction and really continue to center the player.
Okay.
And so the way I've been, because we've been pitching this game, and I talked yeah. a little bit about that in the GDC episodes,
yeah.
is that this is a true story as told by the player.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So it's the story of the time they went to this space.
Okay.
So there isn't like a secret to uncover, and you know, and that gives us some limitations as to how we pace things.
Yeah,
it really impacts how the ending works.
Yeah,
because it does have a big moment,
mm-hmm.
But it's you know, it's partially meta, but it's not designed to be a twist or a reveal.
Okay,
it's meant to be a confrontation of the player. They make a choice about how they felt about their time, essentially.
Okay.
That's the, again, a little bit outside the scope. I do want to detail all of this at some point
yeah,
on
yeah.
the show. But, so the title of my topic is Story Players Won't See. And so I think there's two halves to this.
Mm.
I hope I can explain myself a little bit, because it is kind of, it is a little bit out of the ether, this topic. But
okay.
I've been thinking about this a lot, because there is this sort of traditional world-building thing that you hear all the time from novelists, television writers, you know, people who do D&D source books,
mm-hmm.
like that kind of world-building, dungeon masters. Like, when you create worlds, you do a lot of structure and components
yeah.
that are not part of the story you're telling. They're part of the setting of what you're doing.
Right, right.
You do an outline of the 67 years war or whatever, and mm. then like that is available for you to draw from. It's available for you to explain why there's a graffiti here, why this architectural style is this way.
Yeah.
Like, it's a logistical sort of, they're tools.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's also a really engaging exercise for an author. Keep them on track for, well, how might this character act in this scene?
Yeah.
Well, I built a world that influences them. So not only do I need to know about their goals in this scene, the struggles they're facing, and the people around them, I'm also thinking about how the world influences them.
Right.
So the more detailed that world, the better, right?
Yeah, yeah. It feels very much like, before a desire path forms in the grass, it's the first couple routes that then start making, you find the desire path from those routes. And
oh,
maybe
yeah.
they get covered up with grass because no one actually uses them, but they were part of how it formed in the beginning.
Yeah, yeah. I think another version of that metaphor is like, it's the first layer of the canvas,
mm-hmm.
right? For that the rest of the image is going to be on.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's all well and good. And we're doing a little bit of that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But I kind of want to make that a little bit distinct from kind of what I feel about when it's like things players won't see, because I'm thinking a lot about, in this in particular,
mm-hmm.
I'm putting a lot of my own kind of experiences into it.
Okay.
And I want the player to feel the way I felt in the proxy that I'm trying to explain, but it's not actually it's not an autobiographical thing.
Yeah.
And so in order to do that, I'm actually just expressing a lot of like personal observations as to how I would see, and I'm being sort of vague because it doesn't really matter what it is.
Mm.
And I don't care if the player ever understands it.
Sure.
I think. And that's like the second half of this is like, you know, and it's like an artistic compulsion. Like,
uh-huh.
I'm building this space and it's looking the way it looks, not so the story can be told in a more plausible or authentic way.
Yeah.
Because we're not telling a story.
Yeah.
We're giving it a place for the player to tell their story.
Yes.
So, like, whatever that story is that the player tells as they go through this space, where they wonder why these two things are juxtaposed. Like, a lot of that is that traditional world building thing where you sort of leave clues for people to think.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I'm extremely uninterested in doing something like, oh, when they see that and that, they're going to make the connection.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Like, I really don't care about that in a way that, like, I want to make sure is not leaving some interest on the table for players, because players love that, right? But this is, like, a creative choice I've made about this project that, like, and so what that means is those connections are mine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't want the player to have them. I want them to make their own connections.
Yeah.
That's what I want from the player, the narrative structure of it.
Okay.
And so, and this may even be a distinction without a difference. Like, a lot of it is about how I'm making this thing.
Well,
like, it might be that the player sees all these things, puts the pieces together because it's actually not as complicated. Because I'm not trying to make it, you know, I'm not hiding things from anybody.
Yeah.
I'm just not directing them
to put those things together. You're not, I think I'm kind of understanding what you're saying.
Yeah.
In that, you know, there's that part where you're doing the world building stuff where you got to write things down because, like, the game can only be so long.
Yeah.
You can't put everything you that involves the narrative or the setting or whatever into the game because players will get bored.
Yeah.
Or among other reasons, really.
There is a reason to that. I want to hear the rest of your thoughts.
Okay.
But there is a reason why those things, another problem with that, which is that, and this is like a third act problem.
Yeah.
Is like suddenly those things start all coming together.
Yes.
You know, and then the world starts getting smaller and smaller.
Mm-hmm.
Because like all the reasons why everything is there start being uncovered and revealed either as part of the main plot or like the connections are being made.
Yeah. And they didn't seem relevant or related before. And as a result, like, yeah, everything. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like you said, the world.
Well, ultimately, once it's knowable,
yeah,
it's definable. And, you know, I don't care, like, you know, how George R. R. Martin you are, like, there's only so much,
right?
You know,
right.
And I don't want to motivate the player to find it all out. I want them to replay the game, but I don't want them to replay the game to find stuff they missed.
Sure.
Because the more they do that, the smaller the world is.
Yeah.
I think.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay. Well, okay. And a
you
lot
in the
of,
middle of a thought.
I think I can add to it.
Okay.
What you said to work with it because I forgot half of what I was
great
thinking.
Cool.
What you want is for players to experience a thing that you experience but come to their own conclusions about that experience.
Yeah,
and how you're describing it.
And I will be playtesting obviously.
Yeah,
but like I'm also fine if they experience something else.
Yeah,
sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're providing them something in which they can, you know, establish their own feelings about.
Can I like maybe tell a story that I think is kind of getting at what it is? I'm hesitant because I'm not sure if I am off base. I'm imagining like if you added in the game a very large slide, you know, and from your and the story that you are telling might be that, you know, there was this very large slide growing up and then when you came back as an adult, it still felt very large. Because you were scared of it as a kid, and then you realized as an adult who's bigger, oh no, it actually was a really big slide.
Uh-huh.
Player who approaches that big slide, someone might end up having a very similar thing of like, oh yeah, there was a really big slide at this playground where I was growing up. Someone might approach it and go, wow, I feel so small, like, against this.
Yeah.
Someone might approach it and go, that's a really cool slide. I would have loved that as a kid because I really wanted to climb up high and slide really fast.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Your lens on this really big slide comes from your own story, but it as an object in space is an anchor. It's almost like you're creating almost like a sense memory, and everyone else's sense memory is going to be different when they look at this really big slide. But for you, the point is both you have that in there as a piece of yourself, and you have created an anchor point for others to attach meaning to this big slide.
Yeah, it's a piece to provide your own context. And I think you're really dead on with that.
Okay, cool. Because, I win.
Well,
darn it.
So that phrase sense memory
has
been a really core part of our pitch materials.
Uh-huh.
This notion of giving players this sense memory of a space that they're familiar with.
Oh yeah.
But they've never been. In the context of the game, you enter this space that is normally a social space, but you're there alone.
Yeah.
Because it's a first-person puzzle adventure game, so that's, you know, that's a constraint, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Driven in part by the game genre, but also the reason I chose the setting was because it's suitable to this idea of being alone in a space you're... How do I say it in the... I've written so much, like,
yeah, it's all
copy. That, like, you know, like how to,
that's not marketing speak.
Yeah, and I'm trying to, like, make sure that I'm speaking earnestly and not just parroting, like, the refined version that I've done.
Sure.
Because it's not... Sometimes it's not always the same kind of expression.
Right.
But I do like this phrase, which is, you're not supposed to be there, but it's yours to explore.
Mm.
So, like, because one of the things we've been leaning... We've been trying to explain, and I think this is a difficulty we set up for ourselves, is that... It's meant to be eerie and alien, but not spooky, and not liminal, and not absurdist.
Yeah.
And so, and that's very hard to do because that is, as a culture, we swim in that stuff.
Yeah.
If things are dark and you're alone, then like, where's the horror things? Oh, it's not, there's no monsters, but like, it's creepy psychological. Yeah. No. It's just not a horror game.
Yeah.
You're very much hearkening to the genre of, story as kids, it's like, oh, we got locked in the library at school for a night, or like, I don't know, I imagine it's like the movie where the Sesame Street gets stuck in the Museum of Fine Art, or the mixed up files of Miss Basile Frankweiler, I think, is where the two kids live. They run away from home and they stay in an art museum and like sleep in Marie Antoinette's bed and bathe in the fountain after hours and stuff like that.
No, that's, in fact, those are great examples. That is very much what it is. That's why it's a sense memory, because like, I, someone who grew up, you know, in a middle class American suburb, like, I have experiences that are very much like that because, you know, I had a life that afforded me those kinds of, like, non-adventure adventures in a sense, you know, that, like, a lot of people have, like, or rather, you can have these mundane experiences that you can turn into adventures because you're modifying the context in real time.
Visiting your school in the evening for an event feels a lot like that.
Yeah, exactly right. Like, being in a library when it's closed.
Yeah.
Like, stuff like that. Right? Yeah. And that's basically exactly this kind of thing. And so part of it is it's the universal and the specific. So, like, I'm providing a space for people to engage with and they're playing themselves, but I'm not expecting them to have, like, nostalgia the way that it hits for me, or to have any kind of, like, sense of real familiarity, because the notion is we are making a space that is meant to seem like I could know a place like this, but I don't, because I'm here under a totally different context.
Yeah.
So even if I knew this place in its normal way, this is new to me anyway.
Yeah, right. I also... This is a little out of scope for the topic, but I have noticed that certain music I have kind of really can describe as like nostalgia for a high school experience I never had.
Sure.
I feel a lot of that ends up kind of how I feel about like Lana Del Rey. A lot of her music gives me that feeling of like wistful nostalgia for but very clearly was not my high school experience and or is me as a person.
That's
but I still feel that.
Yeah, that's another great way into what we're trying to do, because like that is ultimately the power of art. And I think one of the, like, you were, the example you're using about like a slide out in a playground that you have your own sort of reaction to.
Yeah.
That essentially you're describing like sculpture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right? Well, that's what I was going to say.
That's how you engage with physical forms.
It feels like you're exploring a museum and you're just looking at a piece of art. And you can't understand, like, when you're just looking at a piece of art, unless you literally know the history of the artist, you can't understand all of the things that went into that.
Yeah.
But it creates this art.
Yeah.
You experience it.
There's an argument that people have that, like, artist statements and museum placards are bad.
Yeah.
Because it removes the opportunity for people to have their own reactions.
Yeah.
And because we are always looking for, I mean, people love to read the Wikipedia article.
Right.
And they, you know, people like always read the plaque, right? That's like
I'm that person.
That's an ideology that I have. But at the same time, there's like, well, shouldn't things speak for itself?
Yeah.
Shouldn't there be a little card you have to unveil once you've had your reaction?
Yeah.
Anyway, that's an argument I don't necessarily fully subscribe to.
Right.
That is an argument for like, these things are not meant for you to know, they're meant for you to experience.
Yes.
And so that's, so yeah, we've talked around a lot of this particular project I'm working on, but I think one of the things that I don't think games do enough of is there's tons of sandbox games, there's tons of like walking simulators that are very sparse. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that approach this kind of direction, but I think I don't know that there's been enough, and this is kind of why I think our project is unique.
Yeah.
At least this is the hope for us to make something new,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily through like mechanical expression, but through like process. And a lot of that is me like that compulsion of just making a thing for its own sake and not worrying it'll be what it'll be.
Yeah.
In a way. And one of
that's so hard to do in this industry, especially right now. So I do not envy your difficulties.
Well, I mean, we pay for this luxury by the fact that like we haven't, you know, no one's paying us to make it yet.
Yeah. I mean, fair enough.
I mean, it's out in the world. There's people looking at it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the more I think about it, And the longer it's been since we've, you know, done our sort of, you know, successful pitch meetings.
Yeah.
It's successful because they went really well, right?
Yeah,
not that I think we're necessarily a shoe in
the money or
for
anything,
for a deal or something.
Yeah.
But like we're in good shape as far as it goes.
Yeah.
But the more I think about what the project is going to be, the more I think like, oh, I'm actually like, I don't know if I would bet on this necessarily.
Oh, sure.
Like, you know, because we're selling it through argument.
Yeah.
More than which is hard to do in this industry in particular.
Yeah.
You know, because like I think in other media it's much easier to you know, like if it's engaging, if it's interesting, people enjoy the form of this medium. Whereas
yes.
In games I think there's a lot more of a focus on because it is interactive.
Yeah.
You need a much higher buy-in from an audience.
Yeah.
For them to accept something new. Anyway, that's kind of the part of the problem we're having with explaining it to others. And it's been going okay. Mm. So I just want to make sure I don't get too confident about our ability to do that because I'm recognizing that it's a difficult task. Mm. But then I have to tell myself, well, there's no amount of challenge that I think that is that's going to change how I approach this.
Yeah.
Part of me is like, well, is that like entitled of me as an artist? I don't know, but like I think about so very recently, many of our listeners probably saw this. People Make Games did a video recently about Jerry's Map. Mm. Do you guys know what that is?
No, I don't.
So there's an artist who started just drawing like a city map on 8x10 cards,
uh-huh.
And in these little tiles, started expanding it out just kind of as a personal project. It became an obsession that then turned into thousands of panels. And over like 50 years.
Oh.
I mean, some of that was like he took like a decade off or whatever.
Sure.
But because it became this process that became more systematized, he developed a game by which it unfolds. So he has a deck of cards which gives him instructions on how to proceed. So it's like, add this layer, move 17 panels this way and add it and do this.
Yeah.
And so it's an interesting game design story. So that's why this People Make Games video focuses on it. But
yeah.
You know, it's been exhibited every now and again. Like mm-hmm. it's in boxes that are just you know, 8x10 pieces of card that are just like cut out from cereal boxes.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But what ends up on those maps over the years of this artist's life have been influenced by almost just nothing but his own whim. It's never been a commercial project.
Right.
It has gotten attention over the years. It's one of those things that you can tell, you know, there's so much of it that the viewer will not see.
Yeah.
So in some cases, literally, like part of the project is that he replaces tiles. It's a never-ending, evolving kind of living thing. It's a piece of sculptural work that he describes as this giant city map that as the years went on, it started getting more abstract. You know, started having like other images projected onto it.
Yeah.
He, for a while, he was keeping track of the sports scores of the various teams around, and he gave names to all the cities, but it's very incomplete.
Yeah.
It's not quite the world building you do for like a big D&D campaign.
Yeah.
It's much more, it's more ephemeral than that.
Yeah.
He would struggle to come up with even where the connection points are. It's just, it's a compulsion.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've known about this project for a long time, and every now and again it comes up, either it gets put on display or someone writes about it or does a video about it. It's really good. I think we'll put it in the show notes. People should really watch it.
Yeah.
But we deal with sort of the commercial demands of our work a lot, but so it's a refresher from that.
Yeah, yeah.
But also there is this like artist tension of like, you know, you make it for yourself, you make it because you have to, you're compelled to.
Right.
But at the same time, I as an artist, I am not particularly interested in locking myself in a room and just doing what I want to do.
Yeah.
I'm very interested in communicating.
Right.
And so I want people to experience it. But at the same time, my compulsion as a practitioner of art, is to not worry as much if it's perceived, and that tension is really hard to reconcile. But I'm trying to find a way through the process to make that work here.
Yeah.
While also like being, and this is a part of our pitch to publishers is like, this is a weird artsy game, but like weird is for everybody.
Yeah.
Like I don't think these are contradictions, but it does sometimes because we maybe don't have the language to describe it.
Mm.
Trying to distill that whole concept into a phrase is really how I came up with ultimately this topic title.
Yeah.
It's like, it's story players won't see.
Yeah.
And it's, and like, what's its value? Where does it come from? Is it, in a sense, random? Is that good about it? How much of it is systematized? Is that balance worth seeking? Mm. Or is one better than the other? These are all questions that I've been sort of wrestling with.
Well, I appreciate that insight into what you've been thinking about, because like these are the kinds of questions that I think are going through our heads all the time when we're making a game. And I'm sure that listeners too relate to these kinds of thought processes. I mean, you talk about this all the time, Mark, and that like every idea is good, but not all of them are good for this game, particularly in this moment. There's a lot of ideas that come to that like build towards this moment that are also kind of part of the narrative of the game.
Yeah.
In not just the creation of it, but also can be part of the game itself. And that form, the artist's, you know, desire to communicate things to people, and also be in conversation with them, because this is a video game, it is a conversation in that way.
Yeah.
Just like, I mean, all art is a conversation. But video games in particular are a conversation between the player and the developer in a way that like you're wrestling with. Mm-hmm. That is just, it's really fascinating to hear that from your perspective. Because I think I've talked about, I mean, we've all talked about it, our perspectives on this in the past, I'm sure. I've talked about it, my desire to like want to communicate things. And this is why I'm doing it. But hearing it from your perspective is enlightening and also makes me feel like I'm doing it right, too. I'm also having a hard time expressing certain ideas and things and thinking about it. And it's helpful to just hear that from other people.
Yeah.
That being said,
well, okay.
You got to figure that out, right?
So. Well, yeah, I don't know. It's interesting because I'm developing a lot of rules for what I'm not going to do.
Yeah.
Like, because I'm still like, I'm very production focused. Like I'm always saying like, that would be great, but I don't have time. Like, yeah. I feel like I'm pretty good at that as far as these things go. I mean, the standards on like keeping scope, keep in check are fairly low. So.
Sure.
I'm sure I'm not great, but like I that is a big part of my working process is like is saying no to things that are my own good ideas, right? You know, having a kind of sense of like, it doesn't have to be anything in particular.
Yeah.
Because there's not a lot of what I'm literally making is not in service of saying a particular thing.
Yes.
It's all this big holistic thing, which is which is definitely my vibe and my way of working generally. Mm-hmm. But I've never really worked on a project that is this uninterested in like what people take away from it.
Yeah.
But not as a ideology of the art,
right,
but actually as the message of this project.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like the point of it is for you to have that experience.
Yeah.
So like getting that framework working is one thing, but actually pulling it off is a whole nother thing.
Yeah, I can imagine that's scary. I mean a player is going to come or bring something to it and bring something out of it, I guess, based off of who they are as a person.
Yeah.
But like when you're observing that, when you're playtesting it, like you're never going to know that like they came off of that because of what you did or what they did.
This is where like our industry
really
struggles to just leave things out there.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I don't really believe in death of the artist, but like it's an adjacent concept where like, you know, you see something in a public park and maybe the plaque is worn.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, that artist is never going to know how it impacted you.
Right.
They may have had a design on it. Once it's in the world, it exists.
And that's that.
And it's what it is like is the result of all those conversations.
Right.
As someone who is, I really bristle at the notion that the artist is absent.
Yeah.
Right, generally. But I think I can have it both ways. Like, I think we can all have it both ways.
Mm.
But it's like not easy.
I know like not absence of the author, but John Green very much believes like books belong to their readers.
Sure.
You know, it doesn't necessarily mean that he isn't there, but if you take something from his books, that's valid.
Mm-hmm.
100%. Right. Like that is something that you have taken from the material and is yours.
Yeah.
And isn't mine, it isn't his to police or to refute or to change.
Yeah. That's like a playtest ideology as well,
mm-hmm.
which is that the player is always right in that way.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, what they get, and we've talked about this on the show a lot.
Right.
There are things you say to a player that you did not intend.
Yeah.
And just because they heard something else doesn't mean they're wrong.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Like you still said that to them.
Yeah. You know? That's what they got from it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh man, there's a lot tied into this
topic
that I'm sure didn't get into, but more to explore.
Yep.
I'm just going to cut to the chase. We need money, y'all.
Yeah.
Patreon.com/NiceGamesClub. Please give us some cash.
Well, what's in it for them?
You get to support this program so we can keep doing it.
That's pretty good. But yeah. You know what else you get to sweeten the deal? You get ad-free episodes. You get Patreon-exclusive content, some of which I have contributed to. Mm-hmm. If you like cat photos, my cat's photos are on there. So through my cat, support the show.
Yeah.
And fling some money at us at
right.
patreon.com.
Now, the cat will not be entitled to any specific number of your dollars.
Yes.
No.
But, you know, Lydia may find a way to, you know, funnel it that direction. So if that motivates you, I mean...
If you give extra money, I will buy her some Fig Newtons.
Okay, all right. I mean, I was just saying we need money, but other reasons too. patreon.com/NiceGamesClub.
Unsurprisingly, I've been playing Slay the Spire 2. Not as much as my husband, but I have been playing it.
Okay, okay.
And I've been really enjoying it.
Mm-hmm.
There have been a couple of things that have been the lead into this topic I've brought is the realization that the two games are so similar that I was reflexively skipping event text without reading it, because in my brain it's like, I know the events, and then I realize, wait a second, I'm not playing the first one, I don't know the events, I need to read the text. What happened? Why is there a room of cheese?
Yeah.
But then as I was going playing more, and also playing more with my glasses on, not before bed, so I can actually see it.
Right, okay.
I've realized that Slay the Spire 1 and Slay the Spire 2 is a very good case study on polish. And that kind of juice, those scope details that are not mission critical, but they do matter. But more specifically, kind of how you add them to make them matter more, right? So I have some examples of quick examples, comparisons 1 and 2.
Yeah,
I'm sure there are more. These were just some of the ones I could assemble in time. For example, Slay the Spire 1, the official soundtrack, has 25 tracks, including the slain ending sting, so whatever plays when you beat the boss or you slay the boss at the end. And then the current Slay the Spire 2 is unofficial because it is still in early access,
right.
But one playlist that I found on YouTube identifies 55 tracks and theme variants. Mm-hmm. In Slay the Spire 1, there's 3 biomes, one per act, and a fourth for the heart. In Slay the Spire 2, there's 4 biomes for 3 acts, and... assumedly, we will be getting a fourth act at some point to deal with the architect.
Okay.
There are 2 possible biomes for Act 1. So when you start Act 1, you either end up in the docks or the undergrowth, I believe.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Instead of just going through Act 1, Act 2, Act 3 and having that be the same. The one that I really noticed, especially, is when it comes to animations. So in 1, the hit and be hit animations are the idle animation, but then slid on the x-axis, either to show like they've forayed an attack or they have been hit.
Yeah.
Plus they have VFX animations and screen shake for the types of damage or the ability effects.
Yeah.
When in Slay the Spire 2, that is the most clear. Like being hit is an animation. Like, like, ooh, I've been hit. Hitting things is an animation. Skills have a unique animation with extra VFX animations to show like, okay, well, what actually is this power doing versus this skill, because it's the same animation for that.
Yeah.
Dying has an animation. Before, it was like cut to the sprite of you on the ground, but you actually are dying actively.
Like animate, yeah.
You and also the enemies as well. That's a lot of enemies.
Mm-hmm.
Idols have moments where they do something unique.
Yeah.
So that plus all of the little animations that they have for things like, you know, block, the statuses, etc. 4 characters, but probably more to come from the vibe I get.
Okay.
In Slay the Spire 1, 20 ascensions. Slay the Spire 2, 10 ascensions. From what I've heard from the developers that is written and findable on the internet, they would, in general, if they want to scale up the difficulty, they would rather add more characters as content rather than add more ascensions or difficulty tiers. So it's like kind of new game plus-ish, but like essentially more and more and more handicaps.
Yeah.
That's where I think they want to go. And then both of them have unique still images for events. So whenever you hit a question mark and an event is happening, like the Room of Cheese, there's a still image of the Room of Cheese.
Right.
It's so interesting to me. And I think it's really refreshing for a sequel to be so similar to the first game, just more. Because that's oftentimes what we want is, we want this game, but more.
Yeah.
And but it also is really, really interesting going back to Slay the Spire 1 and realizing just how good of a game it is without all that other stuff. It is still very, very solid. It still stands up as a game. It's not a clear degrade in any way.
Yeah, you look at Mario 3 and you're like, Mario 1 looks quaint, I guess.
Yeah.
But you only feel that really because you've seen Mario 3.
Right.
That's not the case here, you're saying.
No.
Okay.
I mean, there are, you know, a couple things that I would call like quality of life improvements, but not to the same amount or effect as what you get for some remakes, right? Where it's like, oh, why are we remaking a game? But also, yeah, I would really like the quality of life things that the lessons they've learned from making these other games applied to the game I really liked.
Yeah.
You know? I think that that's really worth looking into, especially when we're talking about scope and having to decide what to say no to, but then also to start realistically deciding what to say yes to.
Yeah.
So, for example, you know, all of those VFX for all the different types of cards and statuses and potions and things like that, all those little animations, that's a lot of animations in one and in two.
Yeah.
That is totally something that one could say, all right, well, that's a lot of art that we have to add that is unique to the cards we're using them for, and a lot of extra programming to make sure that the right ones show and appear and all the timing is and stuff. That is integral and really does make a difference, especially because you don't have character animation showing, I'm hitting, oh, I'm being hit, oh, I blocked everything.
Yeah.
Or I'm doing poison damage versus I'm doing electricity damage or whatever. That I would say. So with that, it is, you know, kind of juice. It's not necessary.
Yeah.
But it became so much more worthwhile to add. And that's part of what makes one very effective.
Yeah.
To the point where you don't notice until you play a lot of it, like, oh, yeah, Ironclad just like moves to the left and then back if he gets hit. That's it. Like, and oh, they were just idling the whole time.
Yeah.
Oh, there's only this many much music. You never notice it. You don't realize it.
Actually really fascinating, because when I first played Slay the Spire, I didn't play the second one. But when I first played the first game, I definitely noticed the lack of animations and things. Because, like, to me, the juice that people are adding to things communicates what the developer thinks should be important for the player to experience. And so it's not so much important, at least in the first Slay the Spire, it's not so much important that you recognize that you've taken this particular type of damage, or even a lot of damage, or any damage at all. You just need to know that you've taken damage. And so that's why you do a little slide. The game has acknowledged that damage has happened.
Yeah.
And so they're more prioritizing the cards move in a way that is.
Yeah.
They in both games, because I've watched people play.
Oh, yeah.
Slay the Spire. So in both games, the cards move and animate and come out.
Like, yeah.
Then that's the important part of the
game. Oh, yeah. That is a form of juice that is very important to the gameplay.
Yes.
Important to the game feel.
Yes.
Logistically important and is worthwhile 100%.
Yes. And they put it in both of the games.
Yes.
And so that's why they prioritize those. But, like, I definitely noticed the lack of things in Slay the Spire 1, but, like, didn't care because, like, that wasn't why I was playing it. And I think that, like, it communicates to players that, like, you know, this isn't as important either, so you don't have to worry about it as much. Slay the Spire was so popular and did so well that they have a lot of budget to add more juice to things. So, like, things get animated when they get hit.
Yeah, this is the question I was thinking, just hanging over my head as you were describing these differences. Is this really just a function of money?
Probably.
It's not just a function. I don't think it's just a function of money. I imagine that, like, I mean, I think with anything, if you have more space, you could put more stuff in your game, and everybody wants to put more stuff in their game.
Realistically,
if you could have all the money and time and like people patiently waiting for your game, you would want to add all the things, right?
Yeah.
If you don't have that, we spend a lot of time talking about, okay, we need to scope down, we need to cut out down the fluff and the juice, so we have to be really careful about what we add. It's When you have to kind of sit there with the scissors, eventually it does get to the point where you start thinking, like, well, is anything worth it?
Yeah.
And it becomes very hard to know what is okay to say yes to and what is worthwhile to invest in time. Like, I personally like to have a nice-to-have bucket for things, especially, I mean, we talked about this before with the scoping conversation.
Yeah.
Like, I acknowledge this is a really great idea. We're never probably going to be able to get to it. I'm going to write it down over here in the wild chance that we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it's worth saving, mm-hmm. even if it's not for this project, but for later.
Yeah.
When it comes to cutting, if it's all labeled as fluff, it all is flattened in priority.
Yeah.
But then you have to start thinking, okay, well, if we have the chance to make it better or we want to make it better, what does that actually mean? And what are we willing to put in terms of beauty, in terms of frivolousness?
Yeah. There's a traditional answer to this, which is like, evaluate each of the things against your design pillars.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I can imagine you would often be in a situation of like, we have the room for this much. They're all equally interesting. Mm-hmm. And so the harder choice is to say, if we can't do all of it, we should do none of it, mm-hmm. which is like what, even though we have the time and money it won't benefit, we won't be able to reallocate it.
Yeah.
That's a hard choice, but it's still based on that idea of like going for design pillars. Mm-hmm. But there's also the in-between where like you can prioritize at a tertiary, notion of like, you know, we can do some of these, even though they're roughly equal.
Yeah.
And it won't hurt the game by doing only some of them.
Yeah.
But then it's just like that's a huge production task that like, you know, can actually slow you down a lot. Like just coming up with those criteria and actually making those decisions and validating that you've assessed your capacities correctly.
Yeah.
Because
you can make a mistake by saying we did a little bit too much, or, oh, we actually cut way too much and we didn't need to, and it's too late to get it back.
And in this way, I think that Slay the Spire 2 benefits because, I mean, they had the first game, right?
Yeah.
If this is literally just the first game, but better. They have the benefit of feedback and mm-hmm. years of it because it's been out for a while.
And because the game is so similar, but just more, like those scope conversations, like the calculations just must have been way easier.
Mm. Yeah, I will say there are new features that they.
Oh, yeah, produce, imagine so. You know,
including multiplayer, which is quite fun.
Yes. Yeah. No, I don't mean to say that, like, this is just that you just re-release Slay the Spire 1.
No, but it is a very, 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 very familiar game.
But I also think that. Because they have the benefit of hindsight, they have prioritized some of the things that they didn't prioritize.
They've already decided what's important.
Yeah. Well, and they got feedback on it. The one thing that I think when I was hearing about Slay the Spire 1 the first time when it first came out, the one thing people would always bring up about it is that it looked ugly. To me, I never understood that. But I think maybe part of that is just like there's a lot of like things missing in the juice of like when things get hit, like you were describing.
I don't know. I can't interpret that because, like, is it ugly in the sense it looks incomplete, which would support your argument, or is it ugly because the spire and what it spawns is ugly? Like, do they not like the art style?
I don't know.
I've asked many times. I don't know what that means.
At least for the purpose of the podcast, I'm going to say that what they meant was it was lacking a lot of those things that was missing it. So it felt a little incomplete. In the way that like you had said.
Yeah.
And so like they prioritize adding those things to make the game feel more fleshed out. And they have the ability to do that because they have a bunch of money, but also they recognized it because of the first game. People maybe gave them that feedback.
Yeah.
And it allowed them to prioritize adding that kind of juice. As opposed to just doing the same thing and maybe adding more cards or something, prioritizing other things. Mm-hmm. Or adding fancier flowy cards. I don't know.
I don't know. They still
see my hand moving there. I think the wind.
Even if they were correcting for that, I don't think they necessarily had to go as hard as they do.
Sure.
To solve.
No. I absolutely right. Like they prioritize it, and they were like, "I'm going to just do it right," and they did it right.
Yeah.
So, like you know.
Yeah, I think trying to circle back through all the things that just happened.
it's a lot.
Part of it is there is that traditional de-scoping and re-scoping in relation to design pillars. That is how you should start with it, especially when it comes to like features and content amount.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to apply that to these other forms of polish because really a lot of it is I want to make it look better. I want it to be better. I want it to feel polished. I want it to be complete. I really want to do this because it would feel better or because it would be a better experience.
Yeah.
And not in the sense of it would then beget these other things. But it would just feel nicer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's and how do you choose that? I think to some extent your design pillars could prioritize that. You know, that may end up telling you, "Oh, I really think it's worth spending more time on sound effects as opposed to visual effects."
right? That's something that would actually, you know, maybe would suit a horror game a lot better than this sort of game. Mm. Or it may, you may say, okay, well then let's do stuff with animating the text and the text boxes to convey emotion. That's where we, that fits better for this type of game and what we're trying to get out of the game. Maybe it can help delegate scope in that way. But for other forms of fluff or juice, it is so hard to decide because it is not necessary.
Yeah.
It's strictly not necessary. So more or less what I'm hoping from this conversation is if you look at this game, these mm-hmm. two games, and seeing, you know, what they did, what they prioritized and how they went about making the game one, and then what they prioritized and how they went about making game two, the fact that they are so similar, it doesn't look like, oh, it's an indie project and then they got a blockbuster budget and now everything's exploding, you know, pew, pew.
Yeah.
Big, shading thing. And stuff.
Yeah.
Like they added in movies.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's not at all like that.
Yeah.
That I feel like it's a very good controlled space where, which then hopefully would help you essentially as a template model for you to then bring those questions to yourself and go, okay, if I had a game one and a game two, what is so important that if it was in game two but not in game one, it would feel like too much of a, like too much of an upgrade and I would mm-hmm. be really missing out. Like I would want a remaster of one for it.
Sure, sure.
What would I 100% go on for like take the chance to do in game version two? But if it's not in one, it will not be the end of the world. And yeah. How do you balance those two things?
I think for those of us who don't have the benefit of a previous game that was released, you can also take the examples from other games. You know, they prioritize different things too. If there were just, there are other, what's the name of it? Monster Train? Is that the
yeah.
one? Yeah, that's another card deck building mm-hmm. game. I think there is a two, but just looking at one, just see what Monster Train decided to prioritize in terms of their juice, and then take that into your own consideration and make decisions as to what you liked about how, I don't know, Monster Train did it versus what you think makes more sense for your game to prioritize. If animations are an important aspect of what this game needs to be, and Slay the Spire didn't do that, then maybe you need to put more priority into how that works. And Slay the Spire 2 did that, but like, you know, again, they have the benefit of hindsight. That is a way to maybe make your game stand out if we're talking about it from a business sense, but it also can make the game feel more like your concrete idea if you want to make it feel distinct from something else. So, yeah, I don't know. A lot of ways to approach this. That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes delivered to you 1 week early. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. Discuss this episode, or others, or whatever, with your fellow listeners on Discord. Stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. Next week, we'll be talking with Rock of Vassos about typefaces.
All right. I'm going to be there for that one.
Yeah. But that's it for this week.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.